Welcome to Animal Concerns of Texas, ACT Radio. I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh.
Here on ACT, we talk about how we humans relate to other animals.
We talk about how we use them for food, clothing, and entertainment, and how there are humane alternatives to these practices.
And we also discuss why a plant-based diet is the healthiest for humans and the best thing one can do for the environment.
So if you're concerned about your health, if you're concerned about the environment, if you're concerned about the way animals are treated, stay with us for Animal Concerns of Texas.
Coming up on today's show, we feature a conversation with Josh Lajani, who lost more than 200 pounds through a plant-based diet and renewed love for running. That's a little later in the show, but first some news.
George Werdner of the WildlifeNews.com reports that Secretary of Interior Ryan Zinke has directed the National Park Service to reverse Obama-era directives implemented in October 15 that prevented certain hunting practices in Alaskan National Park units. Zinke is attempting to reinstate the killing of black bears with cubs and hunting them with dogs, hunting grizzlies over bait like donuts and bacon, killing of wolves and coyotes as well as pups during the denning season, and the shooting of caribou from boats as they attempt to swim rivers. It's an unfortunate fact that Alaskan Game and Fish permits all of these activities on non-national park units. That fish and game agencies condone such ethically questionable activities is really the bigger problem. The original decision to prohibit these practices was justified by the National Park Service on ecological and ethical grounds. The National Park Service correctly asserted that these state-condoned wildlife killing practices could alter or manipulate natural predator-prey dynamics and natural ecological processes. The agency also concluded that these practices were inconsistent with sport hunting guidelines for Alaskan National Park units and might endanger public safety. The Alaska Fish and Game asserts that it used science to manage wildlife and any effects to the natural abundances, diversities, distribution, densities, age class distributions, population, habitats, genetics, and behavior of wildlife from implementing its regulations are likely negligible. This despite a growing body of scientific research showing that hunting does negatively impact genetics, behavior, distribution, and other factors. Ironically, Zinke is alarmed that hunting participation by Americans is in decline and that he believes that making legal such abhorrent practices will reverse this decline. What it will do is only reduce the social license among the greater public for the support of hunting in general. The National Park Service correctly asserts that the proposed trapping hunting changes proposed by Zinke ignores the Park Service's mandate to manage for ecological integrity. For more information, go to www.grizzlytimes.org.
From One Green Planet, the ongoing opioid epidemic has resulted in the deaths of thousands of people in the U.S. and Canada. But it's not just affecting humans. A recent study revealed the detrimental consequences our drug crisis is creating for our aquatic wildlife. This past winter, a team of researchers from the Washington State Department of Fish and Wildlife released clean, healthy mussels into the waters of Washington's Puget Sound. When they retrieved these same mussels 3 months after the fact and tested for contaminants, the results were unsettling. The mussels had picked up traces of oxycodone, as well as chemotherapy drugs, antidepressants, antibiotics, and heart medications. How did this slew of nasty pharmaceuticals get into the water? According to lead study biologist Jennifer Langsberry, chances are they were flushed down the toilet or excreted by humans, and wastewater management systems do not effectively filter them out before the water made its way to the ocean. Although mussels probably don't metabolize the drugs since they're filter feeders, the chemicals floating around in the water may have larger implications for other species in the area, as they can affect the growth of organisms, their hormone systems, and their ability to reproduce. The tested mussels became contaminated a good distance away from commercial shellfish beds, but as we know, pollution spreads quickly throughout our oceans and can end up in the bellies of sea creatures who dwell in even the deepest waters. According to a recent study from the University of Ghent, people who consume seafood regularly ingest about 11,000 pieces of plastic in the process each year, largely thanks to society's love of disposable plastics. When you consider the long list of potentially hazardous substances that have been found in aquatic animals, staying away from seafood seems like the best move for your own personal health. Aside from keeping tiny pieces of plastic and random chemicals from going into your body, reducing your seafood consumption will also help protect our ocean's delicate ecosystems, which are currently being jeopardized by reckless fishing methods. If nothing else, this study is a reminder that we're all connected in our ecological web. And while we may not be able to completely control how our medications make their way into the water supply, we can help to reduce other forms of pollution like plastic. To learn more about how you can protect ocean health by lessening your plastic usage, check out One Green Planet's Crush Plastic campaign.
Of the 327 million people living in America, Over 41 million will experience hunger at some point during the year, according to the U.S. Department of Agriculture. But it doesn't have to be that way. According to a report recently published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, the United States could feed all 327 million Americans, plus another 390 million more, if everyone went vegan. It takes much more land to produce edible protein from pigs, cattle, and chickens than it does to grow it from plants. If U.S. farmers took all the land currently devoted to raising livestock and used it to grow plants instead, they could sustain more than twice as many people as they do now, according to the report from the National Academy of Sciences. The researchers calculated how much protein could be produced on an area of land. An area that can produce 100 grams of edible protein from plants would only produce 60 grams of protein if it were used to produce eggs. If that land were used to raise chickens, it would produce 50 grams of protein in the form of poultry. If that area of land which could produce 100 grams of plant protein were devoted to dairy cows, it would provide only 25 grams of protein in the form of milk products. If that land were used to raise pigs, they would provide 10 grams of protein from pork. And if you put cattle there, you get just 4 grams of protein in the form of beef. If America went vegan, it would also mean better health, and it would reduce medical costs. And greenhouse gas emissions would be greatly reduced if only America went vegan. Is it an impossible dream? According to a report published last year by the research firm Global Data, veganism has increased by 600% since 2014. We hope this trend continues.
Stay with us. Coming up next, we feature a conversation with Josh Lajani. In 2011, Josh found himself weighing in at over 400 pounds. Since then, he's lost 200 pounds, developed a love for running, and eats a plant-based, plant-powered diet. He's an aspiring athlete and even graced the cover of Runner's World US in 2016. That's next on Animal Concerns of Texas. Joining us now on Animal Concerns of Texas is Josh Lajani. Thanks for being with us, Josh.
Hey, thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, Josh, can we start out by having you tell our listeners what prompted you to go vegan?
In the very beginning, as a guy who grew up in South Louisiana hunting and fishing, I can tell you what didn't prompt me to go vegan was really honestly the animals. Uh-huh. What did was I was really wanting to become a better runner, and I read about Scott Jurek, which kind of got me down that vegan rabbit hole. And so I learned of Rich Roll and Brendan Brazier, and that sort of got me there and got me to the point to where I was wanting to, I watched Forks Over Knives, and then I started starting to connect all of the health benefits of what I had seen manifest in my family's health outcomes based on what I knew how we ate, and to be able to see those connections between the food and the chronic disease outcomes be so clear. That is what drove me over the edge. Now, since then, that was the first domino to fall. But since then, since I have felt a lot better by going plant-based and all of these things, and my consciousness has honestly shifted, and I am a lot more, I guess, in touch with the animal aspect of veganism, and more empathy has grown in me as someone who has killed several dozen animals, probably hundreds of animals in his lifetime.
Right.
So that sort of thing has sort of crept in a side door as I've been sort of barreling forward in health and fitness and trying to learn how to manipulate a plant-based diet to manifest better athletic outcomes.
I think that happens to a lot of vegans. They go for one reason, and then all the reasons begin to make sense.
Right. You start to float above it all, and you see it all more as a whole, like a whole concept, and see how it's all like part of what I it just makes good sense as a natural default for the human animal to be largely herbivorous. And then when you zoom out further from our species, you start talking about sustainability and how we connect with other earthlings and like all of the, it checks all of the boxes. Like Rich Roll says, it checks all the boxes. You got to, you know, if you care about the environment, this is the best way to help. If you care about animals, this is the best way to help. If you care about human health and the fact that we're dying, even though we spend more money than anyone else in the world on health care, but we're the sickest at the same time, if you care about mitigating that fact.
Right, absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, and also, Josh, you have to remember that you said that, you know, you kill dozens or even hundreds of animals, but people are doing that every day with their diet. So,
right.
I mean, when you go out and hunt and, you know, actively kill an animal as an individual, it's really not that much different than people making the decision in the grocery store to buy animal flesh.
Oh, but it's totally different because it's totally different because you have that visceral connection to the thing you're eating. And so they don't have to go through that part, and they just sort of get animal parts commoditized in their brain instead of it being a part of a living thing. I saw the duck flying towards me. I make that very, very real connection between what I'm calling food and what was once a live animal. And so people who are going out in the wilderness and doing that, there's a deep connection to that. I get that. And you're right. People don't realize that by participating in the dollar stretch of ribeyes at the local grocery store, you are part and parcel to a paradigm that is doing things on an order of magnitude worse than anything that these guys in the woods might be doing. If you understand what I'm trying to say, it's the same as far as they're both killing animals, but at the same time, the part that kind of keeps you in check because you have to feel the death of this animal with your own hands, the fact that it's hard to get them and collect them because you have to go out in the wild, that sort of regulates available quantity to you. Whereas in the supermarket world, man, it's just another piece of thing to buy to eat.
Yeah.
And you are circumventing that very difficult part of attaining an animal as food in a way that's unhealthy and really spikes the quantity that you're even able to achieve. These are quantities of meat, like animal parts in our human bodies that are completely alien to anything we've seen in our evolution.
Yeah.
And so that just makes really good logical sense to eat mostly plants.
When I was visiting Montana some years back, I met a group of people that I called wildatarians. They didn't have a problem with going out and killing an animal in the wild for food, but they didn't want to support factory farming and all the torture that's involved in that.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Josh, I think, you know, in Texas, we're known for always, or not always, the healthiest of foods and big plates of food. You grew up and born and raised in southern Louisiana. I'm wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about what your childhood was like and what your relationship with food was growing up.
Yeah, of course we ate all of the things that we killed or caught, you know, whether it was in the boat, if we went and caught a limit of speckled trout, or if we killed our limit of deer or ducks over the weekend. Of course we had that, but we also would take those animals and we would pound out their flesh and roll it up with cheese and cover it with bacon and then deep fry it and do all of these alterations and taint these very recognizable food to our, you know, evolutionary biology. But, you know, we wrapping it in bacon and covering and stuffing it with cheese and, you know, battering it and deep frying it and having beer while we cook it and consume it and snack as we cooking. I mean, because we cooking all day long for what we're going to eat this evening, but the whole time we cooking, we eating hog head cheese on crackers and boudin, drinking beer.
And then what happened to your health during this childhood diet of this?
Well, I mean, just like everybody else, everybody gets a little heavier, and it's just a default, like, yeah, well, he's getting a little fat. Like, everybody just sort of, you expect to sort of get a little heavier and wind up on cholesterol and blood pressure medication like every other grown man, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it just becomes a thing that is just like, it's a norm. And it's a shame that it's the norm, because that's the path of least resistance for, like, oh, I'm upholding these traditions, and yes, it's putting some weight on me, but they have these pills that help dad stay alive. So, you know what I mean? And
right. It's like, yeah. Well, you know, you played football in high school, and then you got a scholarship to play in college, and by then you're already pretty big, according to what I read about your bio. What was going on with your weight when you were in the football world?
When I was in high school, I was probably 280-ish, so 280 to 295, depending on where, between my junior and senior year. And I played on a defensive line then. But then when I went to college, they wanted me as an offensive lineman. I wasn't really fast enough or powerful enough to be a real useful defensive lineman at the NCAA level, I don't guess, or at least that's what the coaches thought. So they asked me to put on 30 pounds so I could play on the offensive side of football. And so that's what I did. By the time I got to training camp, I was like about 320 pounds.
So you were basically a tree stump.
Yes, that way I could. Yeah, that way I had some mass and I had some girth for a linebacker or a lineman to have to get around. But I also had enough quickness and ability to stay in front of that very athletic, you know, defender. And so that was a whole different ball game for me. That was a different mindset. I was used to charging and being that guy, and now I'm charged with sort of staying put, being a heavy anchor type of guy, but still need quick feet and quick hands to stay in front of this guy who's charging to get to the quarterback behind me, who I can't see, but I'm trying to keep him from getting hit, you know? And that was a whole different ball game, everything, and things didn't go really well.
That's a little bit more than the freshman 15, I guess.
Yeah, I was heavier than I'd ever been, and I was doing things with my body that I'd never been asked to do, like going through shoots lots and lots of grass drills and lots of just different things that I had never done before. And I'm attempting to do it with this really heavy body that I'm not really used to because I didn't put on much muscle at all. That was mostly just fat. And I was really out of shape going into training camp. And I just, you know, your form gets sloppy and things get bad. And I'm, you know, playing against the toughest competition I'd ever experienced in my life. And I got really hurt. I just got really hurt.
And so, and then you ended up leaving school, and unfortunately, it sounds like your weight continued to.
Yeah, pretty much. My weight just sort of ballooned up after football was gone, because I mean, football, it was a pretty calorically taxing hobby to have. So because I played football and I ate 8 ice cream cones after my meal at the cafeteria, ice cream, you know, with the soft serve, they had all you wanted. Soft serve at the cafeteria, and we'd just smash ice cream cones. But I could get away with all of that stuff because I needed to stay big, and I was burning so many calories that it was like, hell, eat as much as you want. It's a free-for-all. And then, you know, you develop those food habits, and then the caloric demand of your lifestyle gets really drastically reduced, and things go out of whack pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And how much did you end up, what was your peak weight after college?
Well, my peak weight was about 420 pounds, but that was like late 2010, early 2011. And between college and that point, I had bounced up and down. I had lost 80 pounds and then put back on 100, and then lost 100 pounds and then put back on 120. You know, I had done that sort of thing on my way up.
Mm-hmm.
Always doing the low carb stuff, just like, oh, well, I just eat as much meat and steak and sausage as I want to just let go of the bread and everything. And I was still drinking a lot of alcohol. And then there was a stint there where I used a lot of that Zenadrin with ephedra until they took it off of the market. That was another weight loss effort that I had in the days since losing football and starting to see it being imminent that I was gaining lots of weight. You know,
yeah.
And that was just me wrestling with that fact without really addressing the hard stuff, which is what I put in my face every time I'm hungry. If we can fix that part, you know, and completely change the cupboard from which you're willing to grab food, then it's not a temporary food trick to lose weight. That's what all of the other things in my life had been. And this really became more about a lifestyle, more about an identity, more about being a part of a solution rather than part of a problem when it comes to chronic issues in my state especially, and in my region especially, here on the Bayou. And so it felt good to sort of take it on as sort of a priority to me. And so it reoriented me, and my food became, what do I have to eat to lose weight? it became something different. It became, oh, this is what I'm learning is wrong with what I've, the way I've eaten my entire previous life. That, you know, and I know the outcome of that entire previous life. And so it became more about, oh, these are really simple things. I love potatoes. I love beans. I love broccoli. I love cauliflower. I love all of these, you know, different things, peanut butter and dates. And like, this stuff is amazing. It's nothing. I mean, come on. And so learning how to sort of find the culprit to what all of my issues have been and all of my family's issues have been my entire life, it's really, is it technically only meat? No, it isn't. But can we make a massive change by addressing that first? Absolutely. That's a big one to get rid of right out the gate. And learning that and incorporating that as part of my everyday, that's what's different between all of the other try attempts and successful quote-unquote attempts of losing weight where you lose some. But then it's not successful if you put it all back on. I mean,
right.
Yeah, it has to be like a whole lifestyle change.
Sure. And that's what doing things like this, like being able to say, okay, now I'm going to take my knowledge and what I have used to help myself and put a more and have a more outward facing approach to it, where I reach out and sort of and invite questions about what it is I have done. And so all of those things have helped me sort of with the sustainability of it. So being able to be part of the community and be able to be a voice in it has been a huge asset in my having been able to take this thing and run with it.
Yeah, well, you've lost over 200 pounds, and you've even been featured on the cover of Runner's World in the U.S. How has the community responded to you? And I presume the actions speak louder to words than words with those in your community.
Yeah, it's been fun. I have seen people dabble in plant-based eating that you would have never in a million years thought they would have even considered such a thing. But you can't unknow the thing. Once you learn and once you see some of the real data about connection between especially heart disease and the way we eat, it's very special to see someone who really gets it and is willing to have that moxie and that gumption to say, yeah, I know it's going to be hard and awkward a little bit in social settings, but dang, man, this is the truth. This is what we need to do. And if we really don't want to have, we don't want to lead the nation in heart disease and deaths from heart disease, then maybe we should take heed just a tad. Maybe we don't eat cracklings and boudin and hog head cheese every single weekend.
Yeah. So I think it's a whole countrywide epidemic. You know, maybe it is more severe in rural areas. And you hear, you know, various reasons for that. But I think your story is an inspiration that, you know, you can change your diet to be healthy, but it's very important, too, to exercise. And it's a good way, if you really want to get things under control, combining the two is very, very important.
Oh, of course. And we don't, and I get frustrated a bit because people always, well, I can't exercise because of XYZ. Let me make something really clear. If you can't exercise, then that's fine for right now. If that's technically and realistic, that if that's really true, if you really can't exercise or get outside and walk extra for some reason, changing the food is plenty for right now to get you some real health outcomes, to really change change the tide on where you're headed. We can do it with food. You don't have to do it all right now. But food, like Dr. McDougal says, fix the food. I think people take their eye off of the ball when they are able to exercise, because I think they feel like the exercise is allowing them to not really address the food quite as much as they should, because that's exactly how I did it. The whole first 100 pounds was that for me. And it wasn't until I really decided to address the food that I, A, went plant-based, and B, really got everything, the rest of the weight off of my body. And so the sooner someone can make that jump and understand that even though I'm exercising, it doesn't mean I can eat whatever I want. But also, just because I'm not exercising doesn't mean I can't lose weight in a really aggressive way and get some really quick health results, health outcomes, blood work results, changed. I can get my cholesterol down. I can get my blood pressure down. I can get my triglycerides where they ought to be, right? Mm-hmm. And you can do that quickly. And so just because you're injured and you can't exercise at the moment because maybe you're way overweight or maybe you have gout or you have some sort of RA, you got some sort of inflammation thing going on, fine. Let's fix the food first. Let's work on the food. Let's make it a priority and let's do it on purpose and let's do it with purpose and let's understand why. So watch the Forks Over Knives. Listen to the podcast. Read the blog posts. Get familiar with nutritionfacts.org. You know, understand who Dr. Esselstyn is. Sort of educate yourself on this world that's not going to get brought to you passively, because the things that are going to come to you passively are things that have motives attached to them, TV commercials, and you'll get information passively. It's not the information you want. You need to go and find this information, and there's a big enough community out there to where it's getting easier and easier to get the nice cross-section of what you need to know about plant-based living pretty quickly and pretty readily these days.
Right, Josh. And along those lines, you know, on your website, you have some great suggestions for Netflix films and some must-read books, and you have some other videos. Can you tell our listeners where they can go to learn more about your various work?
Yeah, sure. My website, which is just my name, all one word, joshlajani.com. And from there, you can follow me on social media and stuff. And I have some education, like suggestions for people to educate themselves on the topics to get a good cross section under my education tab on my website. But just follow me there and check me out and hit me up, and we can, you know, if you have any questions about what I'm doing, I'm also working on another a project right now called wellstarthealth.com, wellstarthealth.com. And I'm really passionate about that. It's something that is going to be an app, and we're working on it. But if somebody's curious, that'd be a really cool place. I'd appreciate it if you go take a look and stroll through the website. It's beautiful. And that's another project I'm working on right now. If you're looking for a way to try to get some traction on what it is you're eating, what it is you're doing, I would direct you to either one of those sites for a next step if you're looking for one.
We've been talking with Josh Lajani. Thanks so much for being with us, Josh.
I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
Again, if you'd like to learn more about what Josh is up to, you can go to his website at joshlajani.com. That's joshlajani.com.
And if you'd like to listen to some of the past shows of ACT Radio, you can find them at ktep.org. Just click on the listen button.
And if you'd like to learn more about a vegan diet, visit the Vegetarian Society of El Paso at vsep.org. Until next time, I'm Greg Lawson.
I'm Tom Linney.
And I'm Liz Walsh. For the animals, the earth, and a healthier humanity, thanks for listening to Animal Concerns of Texas.